Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Plum, and I am your host of A Pen and a Napkin Podcast, the weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome back to our interview series, episode, oh geez, I just realized this right now, 222. Two balls, two strikes, two outs. I feel like I got to shape my baseball cap here. So Brad Fisher, the women's basketball coach at the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. Excited to have Coach Fisher on here. We've been circling each other the last, month or so, and we finally got this nailed down. So really excited to have Coach on here. But before we get to Coach Fisher, we want to, of course, talk about our founding sponsor, Cosac Chiropractic, located at 144th and Maple here in Omaha, Nebraska. Coaches, if you or any of your athletes are struggling with balance, neck, or spinal issues, have them go see Dr. Kevin or Dr. Heidi. Give them a call, 402-964-0300. Follow us on Twitter at A Pen and a Napkin. We try to put out daily coaching tidbits on the Twitter handle, so sure be sure to follow us there. If you're listening, go to iTunes, go to Spotify, give us 5 stars, write nice things about A Pen and a Napkin and Coach Fisher and everybody involved here, because when you do that, it moves us up the rankings. When people look up basketball coaching podcasts, we move up. I don't know how it works. I just know it works. So if you would do that, that would be great. Questions, comments, suggestions, or ideas, email me apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Go check out apenandanapkin.com. It's a coaching website I put together to help coaches out, and there's a lot of good stuff on there, so be sure to go check that out there. So enough of that hullabaloo. Coach Fisher, how are we doing this fine Sunday evening?
Excellent, Marty. Thanks again for having me. Glad we figured out a time finally to get this done.
Yeah, well, you know, you live that highfalutin lifestyle in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. It's kind of hard to get a hold of you there, you know. So, but before we get into anything, you know, let's put our NBA 2K hat on here. You're a big Milwaukee Bucks fan. You're probably reeling a little bit from the first round loss here to the Pacers. What do your beloved Bucks need to do here in the next year or two to maximize the window of Giannis Antetokounmpo?
Oh boy, Marty, that's like salt in the wound. It's still too
sorry,
fresh.
Man. I apologize.
No, I am a diehard, and it's the one sport that's kind of kept me. Once I became a head coach, I lost a lot of that emotional capacity to care about teams, and the Bucks were kind of the one.
Yeah,
and the Bucks were the one that kind of stuck because their playoffs would come up when our season was over, and so super disappointing. Obviously, without Giannis ever touching the floor, that was a big part of it. I've been trying to be the eternal optimist that they get an off season with the same coach, and Dame's back, and Chris Middleton's healthy, and Giannis probably does things a little different. I think he went too hard all season, which people are asking NBA players to go harder, and he's one that always does and kind of, I think, paid for it at the end. But they did make some changes along the perimeter and get more athletic and younger. And, they had a Drew Holiday team about 2 days before the season started, and then it became a completely different team when that trade happened. So
yeah,
I'm gonna give them some grace to go find some more athletic wings that can do a better job guarding the ball. But yeah, it was a painful and Tyrese Halliburton's from Oshkosh, so so that was a double hit with the Oshkosh guy kind of knocking him out. But I'm a believer that the Bucks will be back and be able to still make a run. I still think if Giannis was healthy, they'd have been in the Eastern Conference Finals. I'm not sure that many people agree with that, but I am a bit of a Bucks optimist in that sense.
Yeah, that's okay. I do think that obviously you lose 30 and 10 shooting 60% from the field and is, you know, obviously one of the greatest athletes in the world. And if you don't have that, that's going to make a difference. And it very easily, I think, was it game 3 that Halliburton hit the game winner over at game 3, you know? So, again, it's shoulda, coulda, woulda, we'd all be national champs, you know? But I think that, you can't tell me that Giannis wouldn't have made that difference, but ultimately I think you're right. You know, that lack of athleticism on the wing is, and the ability to defend and do that stuff, I think that was the thing that has that was their bugaboo this year.
Yeah. Giannis averaged like 42 or something against the Pacers. Like they had nobody to handle him. And all those games in the regular season were under Adrian Griffin when their transition defense was just atrocious. And so I thought they kind of cleaned that part up with Doc. And that's why the hope was he can get back and anchor and he could have guarded Siakam. Yeah. But the Pacers fans would say they were like 8-2 against the Bucks or 8-3 against the Bucks this year, and I couldn't argue that either. So they need to retool the perimeter a little bit and probably make a decision on either Portis or Lopez. I would guess one of them's not back, but it'll be an interesting offseason. It started way too early as far as I'm concerned.
You know, you just have to grin and bear it a little bit. Bill Simmons always said, I'm a diehard Cubs fan. And he always, you know, Simmons always said, once your team wins a championship, there's a 5-year grace window. You can't really complain too much. And I think you guys are 2 years removed. Now I'm long past 2016. That's way past in the rearview mirror. So, but the Cubs are off to a good start this year. So I'm excited about that. They do need to maximize this window. I do think you're right. I think either Lopez or Portis or maybe even both might not be back next year, just to diversify the roster more and just give them more depth. I think that's the biggest thing that they need. So.
Yeah, there's probably 5 guys that I would say are safe. I think everyone else is definitely has at least a half a foot out the door or the ability to not be back.
Yep. So, well, hey, let's dive into it, Coach. You've had a heck of a run there at Oshkosh. I guess, you know, we'll begin this the way we normally do. Coach, tell us a little bit about yourself, about your basketball journey and your journey there at the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh with the women's basketball program.
Yeah, the plan was not to be a college basketball coach, and I kind of backed into it because I needed a little money in college when I was done playing. My body I wasn't athletic enough, I wasn't dynamic enough, and I got beat up enough where it became a question of, do you keep doing this poorly, or do you use what you know about basketball and make a little money, you know, finish college and then figure out what you're doing next. And I started coaching. I coached a junior college with one of my college teammates when he got the job, and then went and coached boys high school with the connection I had there over where I went to school. And kind of by chance, I had a friend that was coaching for the women's team at UW Lacrosse, and one of the days that I didn't have to drive to my high school job, he asked if I wanted to come in and play as a scout team player. And so I came in and played, and it was the first time I had really been around women's basketball. I definitely hadn't worked with college women's basketball players. And in the middle of scrimmaging with them, I saw a couple of things. I was working in the post, and it's like, I think if you did this, or, you know, try to keep this foot down and see if you can rip this. And so just kind of through that process of being a scout team player, I then approached the coach about asking if she was okay with me, you know, mentioning some things to the girls as I was playing. And so that process turned into a realization that at least at that time, I thought women's players listened. Mm-hmm. And wanted to be coach, maybe more than my boys did at the high school level. And whether that's true or not, that's how I felt. And that coach actually asked me then if I would consider coming the next year as a volunteer, and that saved me some drive time. So that was my process to get into the women's game, and I found it just a different level of attention and willingness to be coached and wanting more feedback. And it felt like what I knew and what I thought I could bring to the table was more valued on that side. And all of a sudden I was a GA the second year. We all opened a full-time job there the third year. So I had 3 years at lacrosse, and then I was kind of off. So I didn't see it coming as the career. And all of a sudden I'm putting a packet together to try to get the full-time job and recruiting, and the recruiting piece I just loved when I was younger. So, all those things kind of stacked together, and I ended up going to Parkside, which is the only Division II school in Wisconsin. And had, you know, the best coach that I ever worked for and ever saw there. And we made a great run. And I think our strengths really worked well together. And, you know, I was just fortunate that timing worked out, that the Oshkosh job opened up after we had went to the Sweet 16 a couple times at Parkside. And, mm-hmm. and you know, 3 years earlier, I hadn't proven that job, that I would be good enough for that job. And luckily, you know, as I think most people probably tell you on here, that timing just worked out. And all of a sudden I'm at Oshkosh, and this is going to be year 13 coming up. And we've had a ton of success, and it's been a heck of a ride for 20, 23, 24 years now as a coach.
Okay. Yeah. So you come to Oshkosh, and you know, it had been a very successful program at the Division III level. But in about the 4 or 5 years before you taking over, it had kind of fallen on some hard times. It had fallen off a little bit, losing about 2/3 of its games or so over the 5 years before that. And then you came in and you just found immediate success, increased the win total by 13 wins, the first year that you were there. What were you thinking coming into that job? What was your plan? And how did you get that immediate jump so quickly, Coach?
Yeah, I think, when I was at lacrosse, which would have been about 7 years earlier, Oshkosh, that's when they were in the middle of going to the NCAA tournament or winning conference championships. So I had seen firsthand that you could win there. And obviously there's a lot of jobs open every year, but not every one of them is a place that you can be successful at. So they had already proven that to be the case, and they just had a tough stretch. And I saw at Parkside, we kind of had a similar build. I think my first year we won maybe 11 or 12 games. Once we got our first recruiting class in, we went from 17 to 19 to 23. And so I felt like, because it was a place that people had proven you could win, that there had to be a reason they could get players there that could do that. So no matter how long it was going to take, I was confident that we could at least get it back to respectability, where we could compete for not a conference championship in the first couple of years, at least put ourselves in hosting games in the conference tournament, mm-hmm. or, being able to knock off the best teams at that time who were ranked. And the great part about our conference is if you can win it or you can compete for it, you have a chance to compete at the national level. So that was the other piece where, there's 40 some Division III conferences in the country, but not every one of them has a champion that can go fight for the national title. So, if you're at a place that has a chance to compete for the national title, you've got a chance to recruit the best players at the Division III level. So I thought, timing wise and how those things matched up, regardless of how year one went, we could have a chance. We've got a great base up here in Green Bay, and we felt like we could make a run. And year one just happened to be the perfect storm of a group of girls that had not won many games their first 3 years. We had two really, really good seniors that were all conference level players that were hungry. And it was one of those teams where if you told them to go bang their head against the wall, they'd do it, because they would do whatever it took to win. And so I think that perfect storm of that, they're wanting to kind of change their legacy with a young coach who maybe comes in with a bunch of stuff that other coaches hadn't seen recently, or some sets maybe that were new to them that I pulled out of our league at Parkside. And we probably caught some people off guard that first year, and all of a sudden our confidence got flying, and we win 20 games and probably came up a win short of an at-large bid. But I know on the Wednesday before the last game of the year, we got a chance on the road to win the conference title. We had a 2-point lead with a minute and a half left. So we checked a lot of boxes in year one, and we had a great recruiting class, and that group took it forward to the Sweet 16 the second year, and we were kind of off and running.
Yeah. You are, like you said, not all conferences are created equally. And the Wisconsin Intercollegiate Athletic Conference, did I get that acronym correct?
Nailed it. Yep.
All right. Okay, good. your conference is a really, really good conference at the Division III level. Does that, it's got to help you stay sharp as a coach, stay on top of things. I mean, we have something very similar here in the Nebraska-Iowa area with the GPAC, where it's one of the top conferences, and especially for women's basketball. And when it was Division I and Division II in the NAIA, it was the best conference in the country, without a doubt, in Division II NAIA. You know, just how does that, just being in that competitive cauldron year in and year out, you know, force you to stay on top of your game as a coach every year?
Yeah, you never get a break. And I think a lot of people say it, and I think our numbers prove it. We had the two teams that didn't make our conference tournament this year beat a couple of ranked teams, beat a couple teams that went to the tournament at non-conference. So, you know, we're going 1-8 this year. And it was probably also the best version of the league that I have seen since I've been here, all the way to the bottom. And we've always had teams at the top that could get to the Sweet 16 and further. But this last 2 or 3 years, we've gotten some new coaches in our league that have kind of flipped some programs. And, you know, now we're looking at 8 teams where every Wednesday and Saturday, you truly have to play well to win. And some nights you play well and it's still not good enough. So I think it's forced a level of focus for our group and trying to continue to do the things we've done, win 20 games, make sure we get the tournament. And every night it's again, a lot of it feels cliche, but I do know we have the numbers to be able to say it confidently that we play in the best top to bottom league in Division III. And this year we had 3 teams make the Sweet 16 out of our 8, which is incredible. And It's going to get tougher. And the hard part is, you know, that people say, well, you only have 1 D2. That's part of the reason that you have the kids that you do. But we also have 8 teams in our league fighting over a lot of the same kids.
Yep.
So, you know, if you cut our league in half and I got the best players from another school right now and a couple of the others, if we all kind of paired together, we'd be probably end up better on the national level, but we've pulled kind of each other apart in the recruiting processes and that part has been challenging, but it's also made for a really competitive and even league. And again, we all proved this year, getting 3 of us to the Sweet 16, that that was still good enough to play on the national level. So there is an iron sharpens iron piece of this, but it's also forced you to keep up on all the little stuff that make sure your program stays at the top, and that part is probably the exhausting part on the coaching side, but it's also the exciting part because people in Wisconsin do care about Division III. We don't have to sell Division III as a level here, and I don't know that that's the case everywhere.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, you know, sometimes that is, you know, especially when you get into larger communities that they look down upon NAIA or Division III, and no, there's some dudes and dudettes that can really, really play ball at that level. Yeah. And I think there's a lot of high school kids that underestimate that at times.
Incorrect. Yeah. It's, I mean, again, I think because our state, it's so ingrained in what our state is, it's not the same here, but we still get a kid or two in every year for visits that, you know, as we start rattling off the people that are on our team already, the first team All-State kids, you know, we had a Miss Basketball finalist from a couple of years ago. Like, we've got kids with high accolades, and there's times when parents and players aren't super familiar with our roster, maybe, where you get some head turns in the meetings, like, oh, wait a minute, that kid is here, and she's coming off the bench here. And, you know, that's part of the process, and we've been fortunate these last couple of years that we've added some players that have turned down scholarships, and COVID has changed a little bit of I think what players are looking for, especially females, especially women's players, and maybe staying closer to home or wanting to make sure they find happiness versus chasing a level or chasing a scholarship. So that in our state is, I think, a little bit easier because these schools are just ingrained in these communities, but it's still something every year that comes up where people don't realize the level of player that it takes to play in our league or on our team.
On April 26th, a series of tornadoes hit the Lincoln, Omaha, Southwest Iowa area. 63 tornadoes in all, some believed to be as large as an EF4 or even EF5. Destroying hundreds, if not thousands, of homes and turning people's lives upside down. folks, if you would like to help out with the efforts here in the Lincoln, Omaha, Southwest Iowa area, I encourage you to go to redcross.org and follow the tabs. Donate if you have the opportunity to do so, any supplies, whatever it may be. Our community is really devastated. We're really lucky. It could have been a lot worse, but whole subdivisions were essentially knocked to the ground. The village of Minden, Iowa, over half the homes were destroyed, and it was a very, very difficult day. So if you would like to help out, please go to redcross.org to help out those who are truly in need. Coach, one of the great things, and you've mentioned this on social media, and you very well should, in a time of just absolute chaos in the collegiate game for a variety of different reasons. You know, at the higher levels, you've got NIL, you've got COVID, extra COVID years, and you know, all of these different things, and there's player movement like we've never seen it before. But you have a tremendously high retention rate within your program. You haven't had a kid how long has it been since you've had a kid transfer out, or what
we've never we've never had one transfer out to play anywhere else.
Okay.
So if they've stopped basketball, or if they've stopped basketball with us, that's been the end of it, and it's been pretty few and far between. So we're super proud of that.
Yeah. What is it? What do you got in the water up there in Oshkosh that is just you know, what do you feel like you and your staff are doing to create that situation where you do have that high retention rate?
I mean, I think we know a lot of the reasons, but I think a lot of it also is still stuff we're trying to work on. You always have to keep recruiting your own players. And I think that's been the focus for us. And, you know, we say it in our process of I think anyone that wins can create a program that people want to play at out of high school. But do you have a program that people want to stay at? And do you have a program that people want to stay at regardless of their role, their minutes, their stats? And do they feel valued beyond all those things? Is their value tied to their playing time, or tied to their stats and their role on the team? And we obviously think that's no here. Mm-hmm. That everyone is treated with respect, and so we've been pretty painstaking in our recruiting process. We recruit less people than everyone. I mean, usually at our level, and speaking in generalities, I would guess most of the teams at our level are starting with a list of 40, 50, and maybe visiting 15 kids, 20 kids, willing to bring in 8 to 10. You know, there's a lot of some programs that have JV teams or tryouts. Yep. And I think last year we visited 3 or 4 players for our class of 3. I think the year before, when we brought in 4 players, we visited 5. And we've been really, really diligent about getting it to the right people that fit the needs that we have at the positions that we have, so everyone feels like they have a fair opportunity for playing time, for a fair opportunity at the long-term vision of, you know, we're not bringing in a point guard every year, or, you know, 2 7-foot or 6-footers, 2 5s every year. And all of a sudden those two kids are competing for the same opportunity. And then one gets it and the other one doesn't. And now they're kind of just behind that kid for 4 years. And there's no ability or it's difficult for them to see the light at the end of the tunnel. And that's been kind of our focus of, do our classes make sense? Do the roles make sense? Does the sophomore class fit with the freshman? And then does this next recruiting class that we're working on right now, do they complement the freshman? And could 3 classes play together and have, you know, whether it's 10 or 11 kids over 3 classes, do those people make sense? And I think it's probably limited our ceiling a little bit, honestly. I think it'd be easier if we just brought in 10 a year and let the best 5 survive and kind of say goodbye to the other 5 and then do that again. And, you know, by the end of that, you have 5 good players in each class, but you also had 5 players in each class that either they stopped playing basketball, which to me is very sad, because if they picked here, they could have picked 100 other schools and had great careers and went on to have great college experiences. And I think for us, it's super important that whoever we offer an opportunity to here and accepts it feels like they have a great experience, but also feels like they have an opportunity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so our players that didn't play, like we have some freshmen that are going to be dynamite players that didn't get a lot of opportunity this year on the Sweet 16 team that won the conference championship, but they're back here in the postseason working because they know that opportunity is coming forward. And we've been a program, like we had a senior this year that played 173 minutes her first 3 years. And the reality is at our level, most of the time that means that player's probably going to quit or transfer. Yep, if you've only played 25 games in 3 years. And I think we do have a lot of meetings and a lot of conversations. And this year she played 360 minutes as a senior. Led us in scoring three or four different times, and had an incredible senior year. And we always say everyone that comes through here has their moment, and her senior year was her moment. And we've got a list now of kids that if it wasn't freshman or sophomore year, that junior year, all of a sudden it was their time, or senior year even in this case. And I think we've done a really good job of laying out a blueprint that, when you pick this place, it's a 4-year commitment from us. You're not going to get cut. We're not going to have tryouts, and your roommates are going to be your roommates for 4 years. And I just think we fostered an environment where people are comfortable and feel like they're important here. And that's the biggest thing that we want to try to continue. And if it limits our ceiling a little bit because we get a couple kids hurt, or we don't have enough coverage at a position, we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
And I think that's the part where there's so much ownership. We talk about how much stock do you own in our program as a player? Are you fully invested, or do you just have a little piece that only depends on how it's going for you? And I just think we have a lot of players that carry a lot of stock in our program, and we're super proud of who they are and who their parents are, because that's another huge piece of the puzzle in these situations when someone's daughter doesn't play and the noise that comes of, well, if you went somewhere else, you could play more.
Yeah.
And we have parents that support what we're trying to do. And I've seen, you know, we've won 20 games for 11 straight years. And I think it comes down to those players and parents that buy in, that know if it's not their time as a freshman, the time is coming, and they've been super positive and super supportive. And I think we've done a good job of finding those people. And now we've done it long enough where I feel like we can see it, but also, you know, we know how to present it and help them understand what to expect when they get here. And then there's no surprises. And then we just work through it as a staff with the players and try to make it the best experience we can.
Mm-hmm. You've had a heck of a run here, Coach. 4 Sweet 16s in 5 years. I think 1 Elite Eight in that run. But not quite to that. To that final four, that final weekend run there. You know, how much do you look at and go, we just got to do the Tony Dungy and just keep doing what we're doing and eventually it's going to break our way? Or are you, is there tweaking that you look at? I mean, you know, you're so damn close, but it probably feels like it's just a mile away as well. So, you know, what's the thought process with that as you, re-gear into this next season here?
Yeah, it's both. It's a lot of the things. Well, it's a lot of things that we've done for 12 years that have put us in a position to be in those games. And the list of teams that have gone to Sweet 16 as much as we have is pretty short.
Yep.
So we're going to keep doing a lot of the same things, but we definitely are trying to tweak. And I think this offseason, we focused a lot on the steady climb and making sure that we're doing the right stuff every day through the week and not taking a month off in July because it's so far away. And now the calendar turns to August and early September, and we're going to try to double down on our work to get ourselves back to where we need to be. So that's been a conversation. But, you know, we lost in the Sweet 16 by 2 to Smith from Massachusetts, who had a great team. They had a first-team All-American. And then they went on to the national championship game and lost to NYU. So, you know, we're tied with 20 seconds to go and needed to get a stop and didn't. So we're looking at trying to, you know, make up 2 points, but also with Smith going to the championship game, we feel like we're pretty close. So yep. I think we've got the right combination of girls right now. We've been young the last 2 years. So we had 7 sophomores this year that were huge pieces. We return a lot of our roster. And even then, we're only going to have a couple of seniors. So we know we have a little window here, but we got to do the right stuff. And I thought this postseason was the most focused I've seen our group in a postseason. And we have to get better. We've lost in that Sweet 16 game, I think, 5 times. We've won it once. There's a couple times where I think injuries played a factor, but mm-hmm. in the middle of March, everybody's got someone out or someone hurt or someone dragging an ankle.
Yep.
And,
yep.
and so that part of it, we got to take that part out of the equation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we felt like we've built a team that can play in any type of game, any size. If a team plays zone, a team plays man. And I felt like we had that team this year and lost by 2. So we've got to get back and figure out a way to make up those 2 and see if we can get 6 or 8 along the way too, on both ends of the floor.
Yep.
So it's both. I've thought a lot since March 8th or whenever our season ended about how to close that gap. And I think I've got a hungry group right now that wants to be the team that busts the door down, and it's great to be consistent, but we've been a weekend away from the final weekend here a bunch, and it's time to knock the door down.
Yeah. Well, you talked about your team a little bit, the malleability of it, as one person described it, your team was like a toolbox this year, and you just you didn't have a lot of red hammers. You had a couple of red hammers in there, but you had some pliers yeah. and some, you know, a straight edge screwdriver and a Phillips screwdriver. You know, and part of that, you know, at the collegiate level, you have more ability. It's not as simple as what people think it is, but you do have some ability to kind of custom design your roster if you can talk to the right kids and get the right kids to sign on the dotted line. But I would assume that toolbox design was by design for your team there, Coach.
Yeah, I think one of the places that we've grown in our process is we started being a little more all-encompassing in the types of players we were looking for from a skill set standpoint. I think when we first started out, we were running a lot of 4-out-1-in and kind of focused in on what we needed as a 5. What does a 1 look like? You know, what's a 3-4? Is it the 2-3 that's the same? And we went to 5-out about 5 or 6 years ago. We had a 5 that could really shoot that didn't want a whole lot to do with the block. And it kind of forced us to rethink some things when she was on the floor. And honestly, it opened up kind of a Pandora's box of stuff that I loved coaching then. Mm-hmm. So it kind of changed how we looked at things. And then the biggest thing I think that happened in 2015, we lost to Kelvin in the second round of the NCAA tournament, and they just physically manhandled us. And it was juniors and seniors against freshmen and sophomores. So that physical piece beat us down. The next year we lost to Wartburg in the same round. They went to the Final 4. They had a really, really good big, and either you got to be better at what you do than them if they do the same thing, or you got to do something different. And we started to diversify a little bit the types of players, but also the understanding that we had to be ready for the NCAA tournament to play against every type of team. And that year we played Calvin. We also played North Central, who was running the Grinnell system. So on Friday night of the first round of the tournament, we played the Grinnell system and went up and down and slowed the game down as best we could and won 95-88 or something, and then got bludgeoned in a street fight the next night. So, you know, I think those first couple of years told me we have to be able to play against anybody. If they want to trap or play 1-3-1 or run the buzz or play slow or bang us down low with high-low, like, do you have a roster that can play in all those games? And you know, through our recruiting process and talking to our players, how many of those type of games can you play in? And mm-hmm. that's kind of the key for kind of where you sit in the rotation, because we've got teams in our league that don't use a true 5. We've got other teams that play high-low and really pound it in the post. And so I think our league prepares us well for that. And we have the toolbox is the best way to say it, but you know, I think the last 3 or 4 years we've become a team where we've got a little bit of everything, and some nights some people it's not a great matchup for, but some nights, you know, we started a guard that hadn't hadn't played a whole lot over a 4 or 5 game stretch. She actually became our starting two the rest of the way, but we played her for the starter for the first time against a team that didn't play a five, and it was going to be an up and down game, and she was great. And we had so many nights where that was the case, and that kind of became who we were. And it was, they're probably sick of hearing me talk about the toolbox, but it really was like, yeah. If a 3 or 4 was having a rough night, we had 3 other options that played a little bit different and can give a different look to a team. And then they'd find themselves, and all of a sudden we had a different group to roll with. And, you know, even in the Sweet 16, our first group did not have a great night. Our bench scored, I think, 31 of our 59 points and gave us a chance to win at the end. And I think that was, even though we lost, that was a good way to go in the offseason, because it was a reminder of who we have to continue to be. And if we can match the blue collar with the hammer and the screwdriver and the, mm-hmm. and the jigsaw, I think we have a chance to have another special season and a special run here. And you know, our group really, really galvanized around the fact that anybody could step up on a given night. And, mm-hmm. and that's hard to do, because most teams we play have the same 8 or 9 kids. And it's probably a little easier to coach on a nightly basis if it's the same kids. But I know it kept our players engaged, and it made us a little more versatile. And again, you don't get to pick on the bracket the type of team you play. You can't play 6 4-out, 1-in teams all the way to the national championship. So you better be ready for any type of team that you're going to see. Transy won it 2 years ago playing all 2-3 zone. And do you have a team big enough and versatile enough to be able to play against the zone all night? So, you know, people force you to do a little bit of everything, and whoever does that best wins the national title. So that's what we're trying to do right now.
Mm-hmm. How do you manage that with your kids? You know, this night, hey, you know, Mary, you might be getting a few more minutes based on the matchup, but you know, Thursday night you might not see as much. I mean, how do you work that with your team, with your program, with your players?
It's tough, and I'm still not good enough at it, because I know everyone wants the feedback to explain it. And you know, as a coach, a lot of times it's feel. A lot of the time it's film and what you see on film and who can be successful. And then, you know, a lot of times it's practice. And, uh-huh. you know, we talked a lot about who had the look this year for those 2 days, who felt really locked in. We really focus on scout report for the other team and how we're going to defend people in that. And then obviously where their weaknesses are on the other end. So for the 2 practices leading up, like who seems like they've got it. And we had a very small gap between the top player on our roster and then whether it's our newcomers or, you know, the second or third group. And so there was some of that indecision there, even on our part of, I don't even know who 10 is on a given week or a given night. Yeah. And, you know, the hardest part is, I think I probably went into games kind of having a feel for who might be a little better fit. But the last thing you're going to do is tell a player that played a lot on Wednesday that, hey, you're probably not going to play very much on Saturday. Like, you're not going to have that conversation. And the same thing, I think, with players that you see working, like, we talk a lot about being ready. And, you know, I'll give them a heads up about being ready. But I'm also not in the business of trying to get someone psyched out, like, hey, they haven't played for 2 games. And, hey, just so you know, you're going to be super important on Saturday. So it was a tough blend for me, because I want everyone to feel good. I want everyone obviously to be happy and feel like they're doing the right things. And the hardest part was they were all doing the right things. They worked extremely hard. They were super unselfish, and it got to game time and you kind of had to go on feel and what that looked like. And the reality is they made me look really smart, because a lot of those players that maybe hadn't played a lot in a handful of games came out and played really well. But then there's other players that maybe had played well the night before or the week before that didn't get as much time, that, you know, are having that feeling like, well, what did I do wrong? And it's hard to help them understand you didn't do anything wrong. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about you. You're the same player that you were on Wednesday. I just felt like this was a little better match. And trying to explain those things in the heart of the season, when you want everyone to stay locked in and feel like their opportunity is in front of them, it's hard to know what that conversation looks like. And And because you don't know when the game starts, like there's plenty of nights where I thought someone wasn't a great matchup and then they get off to a good start and all of a sudden they've played 26 minutes and I was wrong. So, you know, going in, there was a lot of trying to figure out who those 8, 9, 10 were that night. And they just did such a great job sticking with it. And we recruit selflessness. And, you know, I know we have players that want to play more and are disappointed when they don't. But those same people are some of the best people that we have that just want our team to be successful. So that's the part where I think the culture and the program takes over and they see their friends being successful and us winning 24 games and know that while they want to be out there more, that things are going well for the team. And that's the part that I'm most proud of, because it's hard in our program with as many good players we have to give everyone probably what they honestly have earned. And, you know, it's only 200 minutes to hand out. And that's why I'm just super proud year after year that our group has continued to be successful and keep people in the program and buy them time for their opportunity to come. Mm-hmm.
Coaches are absolutely loving our taking over a new program booklet. As many of you know, I spent 2 years outside of coaching, and during that time, I hung a note card in my workspace at school that said, "Strip the house down to the studs." I took that time to really rethink and reorganize my thoughts on what it takes to run a transformational program. As I prepared for the possibility of coaching again, I organized these thoughts into this 96-page booklet. How much do I trust this booklet? I used this booklet as I went on interviews to help sell myself and my vision for what my new program would look like. If I'm using it to sell myself, why wouldn't I recommend it to you, my listeners? This booklet will help you look at any part of your program, no matter what stage you're at in your program, and help improve it in some way. It's all yours for only $15, which includes shipping and handling. For more information, email me at apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Coach, at this time, let's switch gears here. You're a loyal listener, so you know we're ready for Coach Wooden here and the John Wooden quote of the day. Coach Brad Fisher, are you ready for the John Wooden quote of the day?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
All right. It took me a second to shuffle through my papers to find it. From page 136 of Wooden, A Lifetime of Observations. It's a little bit longer one here, Brad, so I apologize. So right. Here is the John Wooden quote of the day. "Some people wondered how I could endure working in such a minutely detailed, persistent, and arduous manner day after day, week after week, for years on end. I could only tell them this: I love it. It was as Cervantes described. For me, the journey was the end. The practice and the planning and the drills were my journey, and I loved it."
Fantastic. The journey, I mean, we just did our banquet last week, and the journey obviously is kind of the conversation of the banquet. And when you go back, and we told our assistants on Monday, it felt like those preseason games were three seasons ago, because how many things happen in between. And I think I love it is the best part of it, because it is what it comes down to. We talk every year about only the 21 people or 23 people or however many coaches and players we have that year, that shared experience for those 23 people. Only the people in that room actually know everything that happened. Like, you know, your players can call home and share things that happened, and the parents maybe know 70%, but all the conversations and the tears and, you know, the pouring of the water on you when you win the conference championship, like all those things is the shared experience that so few people have. And that's why our senior night is just a big ball of tears, because you've got 4 years of shared experiences that are all about the journey. And it's arduous and it is minutely detailed. That's all that is so well said. Obviously he doesn't miss on his quotes.
But yeah, he did all right. Yeah.
And like to be able to pull that out as how to think back on what it actually is you're doing in those moments, but how the big picture kind of overplays it. It takes apart everything that, you know, a 24-6 season is, and we're ready to try to do it again.
Yep.
And you just keep kind of moving on to the next thing, and some of those things fade a little bit, but, you know, we hope for our players for the 4 years or 5 years that they were here that's the part that they take with them, and that their arduous and detailed minute things that they did, you know, were worth it for the journey.
Mm-hmm. Well, Coach, let's dive into it here. Let's get basketball nerdy here, and let's dive into your philosophy. You know how this goes here. I will try and interrupt politely if I feel the need to interrupt. But let's talk a little pack line defense here. You know, I think a little bit of a birthright up there in Wisconsin with the Bo Ryan, Dick Bennett influence. But, you know, tell us a little bit about your pack line philosophy, where it comes from. Maybe talk about how you implement it, some drills that you might put into place to make it work. Let's talk a little pack line here.
Yeah, the influencers are what you said. It was Dick and Bo and protecting the lane. Like, if I was coaching high school, I wouldn't probably use it necessarily. We don't have shot clocks yet in Wisconsin, so we're all hoping that happens here soon. But at the college level, for us to be able to protect the lane, and obviously the three-pointers changed it. But those guys, that was just – you watch Badger basketball, and that's all you saw. And you know, my first year here, because we did not play the pack when I was at Parkside, so – my first year here, we weren't probably quite as athletic as I thought we needed to be in our league. So I thought it protected us a little bit. And now for 12 straight years, it's been our defense. And I think we've been able to take some defenders that maybe weren't the best defenders necessarily in their high school, because they weren't as laterally quick and weren't able to, you know, be as aggressive on the line for a lot of their switching or deny teams, and get them in a gap. And I think the high IQ kids had a really good understanding of their angles and where they need to be. And we have a drill that we always do the first day of practice called guard your yard, where we'll set up shoots on the wing, two wings in the corners, and we'll have one corner in the opposite wing go, and we'll put them in position groups, and we either put tape down and we have them stretch their arms out, and really just try to get them to visualize that if you can just protect this amount of space, everybody else does their job. You can guard the player you're guarding and take that pressure off of them. And I think they've been able to internalize that a little bit, that they don't have to be as quick as the kid they're guarding. If they can just get them outside of their shoots and, you know, wedged into the gap or get them on our weak hand. And that's probably the biggest thing that we do with our pack, maybe not the same as others, is we are hard into scout reports, and we will change everything we do on a night-to-night basis based on individuals, for sure, collectively, obviously, but individual scout reports for sure, on whether they're shooters or drivers and how strong they are with their weak hand and things like that. And so we think the combination of the two of protecting the gap, keeping people out of the lane, but also making them go to their second and third option, those combinations are probably the biggest things that we focus on in the early part. And then we do have a lot of competitive drills that we like to do in pack. Non-negotiables drill is probably our players' favorite, because there is an end time. So non-negotiables, we make our list of the things that we're not going to allow.
What are some of those things, Coach?
Yeah, so we have six or seven. I'm going to forget some, I'm sure. But. Sure. We usually do it 4-on-4 to spread the floor out a little bit. But anytime the ball touches the paint, that's a point against you. Anytime a rhythm jump shot from anywhere, that's against you. You foul, that's a point. You get beat baseline, that's a point. Post touch is a point. Any layup around the rim, even contested, is a point. I think I'm missing something. Any uncontested shot, obviously. But so we have like six things. So I stand underneath the basket. We start the clock at 90 seconds. We usually have three groups, but that first group stays for all 90 seconds, and then you just play the possession. Mm-hmm. So anytime those happen, I throw up my hand. Our assistants keep clicking points up. So if you get beat baseline and they get to the basket and lay it in, it's a point for the baseline beat, a point for the layup, and a point for the basket.
Yep.
Offensive rebound's another one. You give up an old board, that's another point. So if they throw it to the left wing and you get beat baseline for a layup, you just got 3 points against you. The clock stops at 86 seconds. Now the next offense comes in, same defense stays. So we keep going. If you force a turnover, you get a point back. If you take a charge, you get two or three back. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of your 90 seconds, after those offenses keep coming back fresh at you, your number is your number, then the other two go. So they like that one because the 90 seconds is the 90 seconds. Perfection is probably my favorite. And that's a full 30-second shot clock. And if you do anything outside of our defense, if you chase a single screen, if you don't communicate a ball screen or get melted on a ball screen, basically anything that we don't like, face cut, anything that we don't like, possession ends and we restart with a fresh offense, and you've got to go 30 seconds of perfect defense. So that one I like more than they do because it can go forever if you can't get it under control. We try to get a competitive pack drill in a day just to get the juices flowing. So break down, part the hole, and then put some points on the board and see which group can win. And we've been able to rotate a couple of those, kill drill where we got to get three stops in a row against fresh offense. And we do a lot of breakdown. I mean, we do a lot of 2-on-2, a lot of 3-on-3, and stretch the floor as much as we can. If you can cover a gap in 3-on-3 and help a gap and recover and get on a shot, you should be able to do it in 5-on-5. So we definitely do a lot of breakdown drills. And then try to finish with the competitors. But we've been either first or second in the league in scoring defense all 12 years. And our kids, regardless of who they were when they showed up, they've taken a lot of pride in it. And between defending and not turning the ball over, we've been really good at both of those things. And I think you give yourself a chance to win every night if you do those two things.
Mm-hmm. How much are you working on closeouts?
You know, that was the one thing I was going to say. I still haven't figured out a great answer for him. My brother coaches high school, and he texted me the other day and asked, you know, how we close out on non-shooters. And, you know, we've started running people off the shot more. Like, we've had enough of the choppy feet getting the ball pulled in our face where, it looks like a good closeout fundamentally, but it doesn't affect the shooter at all. So we've flown out a lot, especially on strong hands and trying to get them off the shot. Like, we're trying to round into closeouts. We spend a lot of time on that and going from gap, you know, one pass away, especially the stunt and getting that first step out, trying to use a kick step to take away their first step and then get up on the strong hand. But we still, if there's one thing I want to figure out a more concrete answer for, it is a straight closeout. But a lot of times we've taken the running shooters, just completely running them off their strong hand and then playing the scramble to finish. And, we've talked a lot, especially last year where we did a little too much chopping our feet and we were afraid to get beat. So we're stopping 3 feet short of someone that is unaffected by that and having to be more aggressive to at least make them put on the floor. Cause I do think we have a good scramble plan, and I think we do a good job of taking away the easy stuff and making them find windows. So we've probably done a little bit more of just spraying people off the shot and then seeing what we can kind of get them into an uncomfortable one after that.
Mm-hmm. Want to know more about A Pen and a Napkin and all the resources it offers? Go to apenandanapkin.com, a great resource for any coach at any level. In addition to our A Pen and a Napkin University video library options that are available to order, we have hundreds of pages of notes, from one-page handouts to book breakdowns to original coaching notes. We also have coaching links, a full catalog of every A Pen and a Napkin podcast, and ways to contribute to the growth of A Pen and a Napkin. apenandanapkin.com is a coaching resource that will help you become a better coach. Brad, you've talked a lot about, or you've mentioned a couple of times that you guys are a scout heavy team, and you have, you know, a little bit more of a luxury at the collegiate level to probably have a little bit more time than somebody like me who's trying to educate the kids on the Spanish American War
for sure.
You know, but not that I'm jealous in any way, shape, or form. But, tell us a little bit about your scouting philosophy and what you do to put together a scouting report, how you implement it into your program, just everything that goes into that.
Yeah, at Parkside, so my boss, Jenny Knight, had played at Louisville, and like I said earlier, is the best coach that I've been around. And she was someone who, so when I was there, it was the first time I'd done scout reports. My first school, I was not responsible for any of the scouts. So the first time I did it, and she kind of showed me hers, the amount of detail that was in those, felt like there's no way I can ever figure out how to get to this point.
Yeah.
But she was also, so I think those first 2 years, we were a little undermanned skill-wise, teams like Drury and some of those schools. Northern Kentucky was Division II at the time. They had high level, I mean, they had mid-major type Division I players. So we were always having to try to scheme to stay in games with them. And I remember multiple times that first 2 years where I'd hand her a Saturday scout and I'd be like, "Coach, I don't know what we're doing here." And she, you know, I'd give it to her Thursday night after we played on Thursday, and she'd show up Friday and she's like, "Well, we'll just play a 1-3-1. And I'm like, "Well, we haven't played a 1-3-1. She's like, "Well, that's what we're going to do today." And, you know, not that that was always the answer, but I think the idea that you're willing to do whatever it takes to win that game is what you've got to be ready to do. So when I got to Oshkosh, it kind of felt the same way, where, you know, we didn't have a ton of depth and we're going to have to figure out, well, how do we make things a little bit tougher? And we weren't super athletic. I didn't trust us to press. And our zone, especially the start of the year, wasn't very good. So we were going to play a pack, and it was going to be a matter of, well, how do we win some of the margins? And, you know, a lot of cases it was putting people on their weak hands. It was really knowing their stuff and knowing their sets and knowing as many tendencies as we could. And like you said, it's a luxury at our level. We have every game of film for the last 7 years for these teams. So, you know, we can pull back as far as we need to. So, you know, I'm fortunate now because both of my assistants played for me, so they know what a scout report looks like. So there's not a lot of drop off or change from when I do a scout versus my assistants. So, you know, our players, we give them way more than they can handle, but we've got some basketball junkies that eat it up. We've got a couple that I think just want the notes. And, you know, we started having girls about halfway through my stint here, would write the scout report on their hands like a little crib note. So you'll see my players. It started out with a couple of the younger girls doing on the bench, and then a player would call over and be like, "What does she do?" or "What hand?" And I'd see them look at their hands. Well, then it became where they'd put their notes on their hands for themselves. And I just think they've taken a lot of ownership in it. And we like to think, and our players, I think, like to feel like we're always more prepared and know more about the other team than they know about us. And whether that's true or not, I think we believe it. And I think whoever does the scout as the coach is super confident going to that game of, you know, what a first action looks like in a set and being able to call some things out. And, you know, we're probably a little bit annoying, but, you know, we'll call, if someone calls out their set, you know, our kids are sort of screaming it out and yelling at what we think is going to happen. And, you know, I get that people probably don't love playing against us for that, but our girls, I think, take a lot of pride in knowing the other team's scout and how to make things a little bit tougher. And we've leaned into it by just giving them as much as we can. And we spend most of our time, I think, for the Wednesday game, from Sunday morning until, you know, Tuesday when we got to hit print and go to film. You know, we spend probably more time sometimes than we should. But I thought we struck a better balance this year, getting some side work in and things like that. But I want to make sure that we never lose a game because their coach wasn't ready for it and didn't know what might be coming. So I don't think I'm ever going to slow down on the scout. And, you know, who knows how much it actually matters. But I think for us, we've leaned into the understanding that we're to make sure we don't lose this game because we're more prepared.
So you're playing on Wednesday. Do you have something for them Monday? You know, so most of the time, do you have like a Wednesday, Saturday type of schedule?
Yeah. Conference is Wednesday, Saturday. So Monday, typically Monday, the film they'll see will be a little more general. Here's their base offense. Here's their pet sets. Here's, you know, how much ball screen, how much transition. So at least we can work on the 5-on-5 of what we're going to see. And then Tuesday, they'll get the personnel and which ways we're going to put people on which hand, if we're going to trap a ball screen against someone, if we're going to, you know, so usually Monday is the big picture, and Tuesday we'll drill down a little bit and get a little more specific. And then when we get into practice, we'll guard personnel a little bit closer to what we're going to do on Wednesday. And I mean, you don't change a ton. It's, you know, a lot of people don't like their left hand as much. So, you know, we're putting a decent amount of people on their left hand and forcing some people to beat us. But, you know, we have just different terminology for how much we put them on that hand and how much we respect them as a shooter versus a driver. And I think our kids kind of appreciate the beats and kind of know what a week's going to look like. And then my assistant is doing the Saturday scout, so she'll give it to me either Wednesday night or Thursday morning, and we'll kind of do the same thing on Thursday with big picture. Friday we'll drill down, and Saturday we'll do walkthrough and feel like we're ready to go.
Mm-hmm. Let's wrap up with this here, Coach. Let's talk about your practice setup and what you do. Just you know, typical day. How's a practice put together up there at Oshkosh, and what are you emphasizing, and so forth and so on?
I've become a big believer in no more than 2 hours. So whatever we need to get done, it has to be done in 2 hours. And the first 10 minutes, we're always going to stretch. We're going to do that as part of those 2 hours and get out the conversations. And I remember Kevin Borseth talking at a clinic when he was at GB about giving the players a little bit of time to socialize and talk. And if it's the first time they've seen each other, here's 10 minutes in your stretch. As long as we're stretching, that you can get that piece done. And then we've got 150 to get our stuff done. So I'm still one of the few believers in a lot of 3-on-0, 5-on-0 type stuff. So we do non-contact the first 20 to 25 minutes of practice. Obviously we're trying to get to game speed, but we've got a long season, and you know, we've got a couple of workouts that we can do with the kids in September now, but you know, they're going 3 days a week doing their own thing, three or four. We start October 15th. You know, we're trying to go to the middle of March. So we're going 5 hard months that are hard on the body. So I'm a huge believer in non-contact and just trying to go at game speed. And so we do a lot of 3-on-0. We call it action shots with our 5-out actions. So we'll do 3-on-0. We'll go up and down 5-on-0. We'll play 5-on-0 and split ends. So we'll get our non-contact through passing drills, you know, simple ball handling stuff with hopefully a second, you know, drive and kick type actions. So we'll get a lot of shooting in those first 25 minutes, a lot of ball handling, a lot of passing, no contact, you know, coming off tight off of screens, but no defense involved. And then, you know, we'll turn the page to rebounding drill, maybe 3-on-3, 6 passes where you can't dribble and handle pressure. So we'll ramp up the physicality. Then we'll get through our defense, typically defense first, but it kind of depends on who we're playing. And so we'll get 45-ish minutes alive, and then we'll usually go back to the last 20 when fatigue hits and go back to non-contact. And whether it's going through, kind of walking through their stuff, especially as you get later in the season, walking through their stuff, going through sets, you know, balls, maybe ball screen defense without contact where we're 5-on-5, but putting people in spots if the ball's here. And you know, it's a lot of a war of attrition. And I think a lot of the times we haven't made this past the Sweet 16 because we've had a key player banged up or someone missed. So I'm trying to get us to our best in February and March and trying to keep kids fresh. And, you know, they don't have to keep looking at the clock to know that we're going to go 2:15 or 2.5 because coach didn't get to do everything that he wanted to do. So, you know, we've tried to go 25, 45, 25 and keep that contact in the middle while our bodies can still handle it. The last thing, and I've had too many years early, 2 or 3 times where someone gets hurt on the last drill or the last, the last possession of something where fatigue is set in and someone's slow to come over and steps underneath someone's foot. So we try to be really good while we're fresh. And then get it back to where we can still get work done without banging at each other. And I think that's served us really well. We've been really good at the end of the year for most of my career, and I feel like we've done a good job of pacing our team with minutes, but also in the day-to-day in practice.
Yeah, that's one of the things I did the last few years. This last year, I don't think we did as good a job, but I wanted to really dedicate the last 18 to 20 minutes to just skill work and skill development, and especially shooting the ball. Just to, and part of it's psychological. You want the kids to feel good leaving the gym. Hey, you know, I shot it well here or whatever. I didn't get my butt kicked by such and such person in 5-on-5 or whatever. But just to you know, ensure that, you know, it kind of cut me off as a coach to where it's like, I want to end this 5-on-5 well. And you're still waiting for that beat, that moment to get you to that point. And sometimes it never comes. And then you've wasted, I don't want to say wasted time, but it hasn't been as productive as you would have liked. And so that's something I really went to the last, 4 years. And again, like this past season, I don't think we did as good a job with it, but I know those first 3 years, we did a really, really good job of those last 18 to 20 minutes. You know, we were going to split into 2 or 3 stations. We were going to get out the Dr. Dish. We were going to get a lot of shots up. We were going to do skill work, maybe go, work on finishing around the basket. You know, the most contact we'd have is going into a coach with a pad or something like that, get out some cones, do a lot of different things like that. And that was good for our skill development. I felt like it was really good for our kids.
Yeah, we've mixed in that with the walkthroughs, and obviously depending on where we're at in the season. But I think we've talked a lot about setting a bar that other teams can't reach. And if we're really going to go game speed, you do it when we're playing against each other. If we've got 17 girls, 5-on-5, we've only got 7 sitting. So someone is going multiple reps or multiple stretches in a row because you're not subbing full groups. So the expectation that they're going to be able to do 50 minutes of true game speed, that's already pushing it. So if I'm going to ask them to do 2 hours and get to game speed for an hour and a half of that, it's unrealistic, and it doesn't match a game, and it doesn't. So I think we've been able to do a really good job of keeping that focused in the middle. Like you said, then you have some leeway then to find that moment where you can move out of the team stuff and feel good about how you ended. And now everyone kind of goes back to working on their own stuff. And, we probably didn't do enough, honestly, from this conversation. We'll probably do a little bit more of flipping some of that to skill work at the end. And again, a lot of it is safety. And I just think kids get vulnerable in that last 10 minutes of a 2-hour practice where things are a little loose, and whether it's their own ankle because they're fatigued or someone's slow to come over. I think that last 20 minutes of people getting back to doing their own stuff and getting some confidence in whatever they're working on is a big piece of it too. So it's served us well. And again, it's no matter what, high school, wherever, basketball is the longest season. So, you cross two holidays, usually at multiple breaks for high school or college kids. So it's just a long mental year. And when you come back from Christmas, you still got 2.5-3 months left. So just trying to get through and have everyone feeling good in February is a huge part of who plays well in the postseason.
Yeah. Well, at least you get to go through that long season with balmy weather up there in Wisconsin.
That's right. We actually, this year there was very little snow, so it felt like March Madness already in February. So we would love to repeat that.
Yeah. Brad Fisher, head women's basketball coach at University of Wisconsin Oshkosh. Coach, if folks want to know more about you or they want to know more about your program, how can they find that out?
Yeah, our program's at UW-OshkoshTitans .com. I don't even remember where I'm at. UWO Coach Fisher, I think. It's mostly Bucks and once in a while some stuff about our team. But I really appreciate it, Marty. This is a lot of fun, and I love seeing your napkin drawings. I love when those pop up and seeing what kind of tidbits you have on the bottom of those. So I look forward to continuing to follow and learning from you and everyone you have on here.
Well, I appreciate it, Brad. It's been a privilege, and with not coaching anymore, you know, I get more time to putz around with that stuff, you know. So I've got some ideas in the hopper here. Kind of feel like, you know, we're getting to the end of the school year here. I've only got a couple of weeks of school left. So I'm looking forward to kind of like a 3 month, brainstorming session with the a pen and a napkin stuff here. And, I think I've got some ideas. I think I've got some stuff that I'd like to do. A couple, you know, I've done the offshoots with the podcasts, with like the film room and things. And,
yeah.
And, you know, we're gonna do some different things there. I got a few more basketball movies I want to cover. So thanks for reminding me, Brad. Add that one to the list. But no, there's one massive project that I've been working on that I hope that we'll see the light at the end of the tunnel here, hopefully around the 4th of July. And then we're going to add some other things in. And shameless plug, I have no shame in this regard. You know, Fall Coaches Retreat, October 12th and 13th here in Omaha. And just had a big update with that, and hopefully within the next week or two we could kind of start really publicizing that and getting that down. So I will miss a lot of things with it, but I am also excited with the stuff that I'll be able to do with this here as well. So it'll fill that void to a very large degree. I don't know if it'll ever completely fill the void, but it will fill it to a large degree. So excited about that. So
that's great. Thank you for everything you do.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it, my man. So if you could hold the line here, let's take this home here again. Brad Fisher, women's basketball coach, University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. Just terrific program, one of the most consistent programs at Division III in the country. So check out his stuff. He's got some good stuff on Twitter. We'll see what his NBA 2K Bucks team looks like after he makes a couple trades and free agent signings here in the offseason. So I want to thank him for his time. Again, want to thank Kosak Chiropractic. Go check us out on Twitter at a pen and a napkin. Follow, download, rate, review. Again, give this 5 stars. Write something nice about it. Questions, comments, suggestions, or ideas, email me at penandanapkin@gmail.com. Again, want to thank Coach Fisher for his time. Coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day